Hey, it's Sandra and Chris.
Thanks so much for listening to Heart of the Enneagram. We hope this podcast is offering you insights as well as entry points for opening the heart.
We offer this podcast as a free resource for personal and spiritual growth. And in order to continue this work, we need your support.
So please visit our website, heartoftheenneagram.com, and click on the link to contribute.
Whatever you give will be gratefully received.
Welcome to Heart of the Enneagram. I'm Chris Copeland.
And I'm Sandra Smith.
And we invite you to take a courageous and loving look at what is.
For anyone that has, has the melancholy that I developed pretty early on, to know that you do grow out of it is a nice thing, or that you can grow out of it anyway. Continuing to do the inner work that all of us have to do.
Hi, Chris. I'm excited about this episode today.
Me too, Sandra, as we explore another question in our series on myths and questions.
In the fine city of Asheville.
Yes. So, you know, this question that we often get as we work, and also our listeners ask, is, does Enneagram type change over the course of one's life? Because folks wonder, you know, if I'm a type 2 now, does that somehow change? And, you know, the quick answer to that is no, the type doesn't change. But what does change is the expression of that type over the course of our life and sort of how we live that out, how it becomes manifest. And so that's what we want to explore some today. And so we have a couple of guests with us today that we're excited to welcome who are going to help us explore how type expression of type changes over the course of life.
Yes, we're excited to welcome Asher Walker Wilson and Ed Hillman, both who lead with type 4. Asher Walker Wilson is a senior at Asheville High School and will attend Grinnell College in Iowa this August. He is an avid reader, loves to travel, has lived in Colombia, South America, and is fluent in Spanish. He's a huge soccer fan and deeply committed to social justice. Welcome, Asher.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being with us. And Ed Hillman is an ordained United Methodist pastor. He served local churches in Western North Carolina for 28 years before joining the Givens Estates Retirement Community as their director of ministries. 7 years ago, he began that. He and his spouse, Leslie, have 3 grown children and an awkward dog named Rocky. Welcome, Ed.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah. So moving into this conversation with you two, how do you most know that you lead with type 4? What tells you that?
You know, I think it would be for me, when I was a child, instead of sort of doing the typical go to another kid's house and play and stuff like that, I would find myself reading and off in a corner and doing my own thing. And my parents didn't think that was a bad thing, but they didn't think it was necessarily a normal thing. And so right away from when I started growing up, I knew that I was sort of a bit introverted, and then that grew and grew as my educational experience grew. And when I typed myself, I just figured that the 4 was really the only thing that fit me, mm-hmm. Enneagram-wise.
Mm-hmm. 4 is a withdrawing type, so that makes sense.
Did you feel different? Is that part of it?
I don't know if different's the right word, but certainly I didn't necessarily feel normal. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it just depends on what you want to call it, yeah.
How about you, Ed?
Well, nowadays, the 4 comes out in me and my the creativity with which I minister, worship, design, and that sort of thing. The mystical expressions of the faith as well. Mm. I still long for that kind of deep connection with the Spirit and with other people that have long identified with. And it's good to be a 4.
What do you like most about it, Ed?
Well, I think that, you know, there is a sense of being different that, I used to have. Nowadays, my mantra is, remember, Ed, you're unique, just like everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
But I continue to like to explore my inner thoughts. I do think that a lot of our spiritual quest has to be within, mm-hmm. you know, not without. I'm enjoying dressing as a four now. I'm dressed, you can't see it, I'm dressed very conservatively in some ways, but I've got on my hipster sneakers. So I like to mix genres as far as that goes.
Don't put you in a category, right?
That's right. That's right. Don't fence me in.
How do you find your Enneagram Type 4 tripping you up these days or getting you in trouble a bit?
I think for me, it's sort of double-edged sword, sort of. I am one of the more honest people that my friends and myself that I interact with, and that really gets me in trouble, just because I need to have the wherewithal when I'm talking to people and more tact when I sort of am talking people through all the different emotions that they share with me, because that's part of the four too, because mm-hmm. sort of being more empathetic and sort of being there mentally for and emotionally for other people, but then you have to watch yourself honesty wise.
Mm. What's your emotional life like, Asher? Talk about your emotional life.
I think there's a lot of shame that isn't necessarily sort of, there's not like a button to press that, oh, this is it. But I think like there's shame, but also there's deep honesty and integrity, and sort of those combinations really are good for being there for other people, but mm-hmm. sometimes you get tripped up when you're trying to be there for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Can you think of an example of that?
A lot of people come to me for advice, like in their interpersonal relationships, and lots of times I end up giving them great advice, and then I don't use my own advice. Mm-hmm. And that leads me down a rabbit hole of just feeling like I know that this is what I should have done, and I know that this is how it gets better, but I didn't do it. Mm. And that's because I don't know why. Mm. It's because I'm in my own head, I guess, but you never know.
Mm.
That's a good question to ask yourself. Why is this? Mm-hmm. You know, what's my resistance about to following my own advice?
Yeah, absolutely.
What's the rabbit hole like?
I don't know. It's a pretty deep one, I'd say. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of an interesting experience, just because I think it depends on what it is. It can be sort of more emotional, whether that's like relationships with other people, sort of like, what am I doing wrong, or how are they wronging me? And that's not necessarily fair to them or anybody. Hmm. But also it can be more just personalized, like how can you be more successful? How can you get to the next place where you want to be, but also not be ashamed by those steps and who you step on and things like that.
I'm so curious. You've talked about thinking. Mm-hmm. And, of course, four is in the heart triad. And it's just an important point that just because someone leads with a type in the heart triad, that they can't overthink
mm-hmm.
Or be too much in the head. But what's happening in the head may be something like fantastical thinking or comparing mind for type four. I don't know if any of that applies, but I think you bring up a good point just in naming thinking.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, those thoughts are influenced by those feelings. I mean,
right.
the dominance is the heart. Absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't ever argue against that for me in particular, but fours in general. But really, the heart influences that thinking. So mm-hmm. yeah, I think you're spot on.
Mm-hmm. Thank nice. You.
What about you, Ed? How does your type trip you up?
Well, a lot of what Asher is saying is very familiar. Sometimes I get involved in these internal dialogues that now, after 62 years, have kind of cut themselves pretty deep, and I have to remember to pull back from that.
Some people call those ruts, Ed.
Yes. I think of them as recording grooves because I play them over and over.
Nice, beautiful.
That's wonderful.
In the head. And yes, the compassion, the empathy with others, especially in my profession, you want to give of yourself to other folks, and you can get, especially if you're under stress, you can get a little too caught up, and I think the two is my my stress go-to place, and that that can put me into this manic giving of myself that is not really a good idea, and can feed on itself. So occasionally I do have to pull back, do some self-care, and realize that I don't have to be there. The other place, and historically speaking, this is true for me, is that I'm often obsessing on what I consider missing in my life. And it's funny when I was first reading about the Enneagram and the kind of the undoing point being envy, I thought, well, gee whiz, I'm not really conscious of being envious of other people per se, but then you begin to notice how you obsess over what you think is missing in your own life, and so that's a point that can be troublesome for me, especially when it comes to relationship.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. When you say that, what do you mean when you say, especially when it comes to relationship?
Oh, my primary relationship that I am in with my wife of 36 years, I sometimes, you know, will sit and think of what is missing when I should be appreciating what is present
and
here, kind of thing.
There you go.
Yes, beautifully said.
Yeah. And, you know, fours, threes, and twos are in the triad where you all very adeptly wear a role.
Yes.
And I think as a minister at a retirement facility, in stress, you're just going to step into that role and overdo it. Now, you may go to two, but you can also just stay right on point because you're overdoing a role. And, you know, who am I without it? And how do you step out of it?
Yes.
Yeah, it's tough, those roles.
So I have a curiosity for both of you about when we talk about tripping us up is mood. So sometimes, you know, as I lead with type four, I can notice that the mood can shift pretty significantly, maybe pretty quickly. Is that something that you've noticed in your lives?
I'd say yes for me. I mean, I struggled with sort of just being very emotional, very angry in middle school and early high school. But, and then I sort of calm myself down, and now it's to a point in which it's sort of, when I can feel those internal moods, and then it's sort of, you got to really work hard to sort of blanket those with whatever you're trying to sort of give to the public that you're interacting with. And that can't always be a good thing, because sometimes they need to hear what's going on with you really deep down. But I mean, oftentimes there are moments in which you need to be mad or should be mad, and it's just absolute calm.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of, it's like an over sort of stepping with that defense mechanism. It's like too angry when I was young, but now too calm.
Well, and there's a big difference in feeling and acknowledging the emotion and expressing it.
Absolutely.
Because the wisdom is, when we express an emotion, we're not feeling it. So good for you. Yeah.
Ed, do you want to respond to that question about mood?
Well, indeed. You know, I can remember earlier in life that my moods were pretty much up and down. I could really ride the roller coaster. I was angry a good bit. In my role as a pastor, though, I was not allowed to show that anger very much. And that's unfortunately one of those classic things when anger gets turned inside. You deal with a lot of sadness and melancholy, and so I dealt with that for a good bit of my life. Not so much anymore. Things have changed for me in my older age. And I remember one thing in particular that was kind of funny. I started seeing a therapist in my mid to late 20s. And I remember, I think I was 28 years old, and about the third session with this particular counselor, he said, "Well, I was reviewing your files yesterday, and everything that you were saying to me seemed familiar, but I couldn't pin down what it is that's really going on with you." He said, "I woke up in the middle of the night last night, and I knew what was going on with you. You're 28 years old. You're having a midlife crisis. You really need to lighten up."
Oh. Yeah, I remember at 25 when I said I was having a quarter life crisis.
Right. Quarter life.
There's always a little drama there, right?
That's right. That's right. Drama is good.
Until it's not.
That's right. Until it's not.
Well, it's one of those ways, I think, when overdone, that fours can create their own suffering. And of course, we read, yes, in the material and hear from other fours that there can be a love affair with suffering. And to really consider as a four how you create your own suffering and how do you let that go. What has that been like for you too?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you throw in religion to it and suffering, you really get crazy in a lot of ways.
There you go.
Some of my favorite books from seminary were Unamuno's The Tragic Sense of Life, you know, because you feel that early on. And yet, on this side of things, you understand that parts of life really are tragic. And but you know, you can have a little bit better perspective as your moods begin to level out and that sort of thing. I didn't used to like being a four. I'll confess that, in a way. But as you said, being in love with your own pain, feeling like you're different, those were things that gave me a little bit of vindication. Now, not so much a problem for me.
Mm-hmm. Asher, Ed talked a little bit about two things that struck me. One is this idea of noticing what's missing.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you notice in yourself?
Yeah, I think that does sort of fit with how I feel things, how I think about things. But I would say that for me, it's more about sort of nostalgia, maybe, sort of being stuck in the past. Because at least from what I've understood about what it is a four is that they get stuck in their own mind a lot. And for me, that isn't necessarily like what's going to happen in the future. What am I going to do in college or stuff like that? I'm not necessarily worried much about that, but just sort of everyday interactions like, oh, I really flubbed on that. I really hurt somebody's feelings, or, oh, that person did me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of really holding on to the inconsequential sort of things from a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's missing is a perfect way to think about that, interestingly, because it's like what's missing is the closure. What's missing is getting away from feeling those things and being able to look to the future.
That makes me think of the image that you said, Ed, about the groove, the sort of like you have an interaction and you go back and you play it over.
Absolutely.
In your mind.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, I got wronged, or...
And I think that might actually have to do with, I think I have a five wing, and so that over-analysis, that sort of leaping back and sort of having that analytical mind, I think that would be also similar into what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. What about sadness or melancholy or those things that you are aware of in yourself?
I mean, I think that those are definitely there. I think Ed was absolutely right when he talked about like anger turning to those. Because I don't think that I have much of that by itself, but because I have a lot of anger, I create those things for myself. So it's like there isn't necessarily a situation that creates sadness, but a situation that creates anger is vicariously then sad.
Both of you have mentioned issues that are up for you or have been in the past. What have you done what kind of practice or strategy did you create for yourself, or are you creating for yourselves, to move past some of these things that trip you up?
I think for me, sort of getting unstuck from the past, being more in the present, but also sort of just valuing what others sort of offer for my own sort of picture, whether that's emotional or physical or mentally speaking in a general sense. I think a lot of times fours get it where they're the only one. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say that they're like absolutely like egotists or like very self-centered, but they sort of think that they're so unique. I certainly do this, that they lose touch with what other people offer. And so as I go off to college, sort of grounding myself in sort of what my parents give me, whether that's monetarily, but also just emotionally, as a gift, but also sort of my friends and that support network that was here for me for however many years, I mean, 15, 16 years that I've been here in Asheville. And so it's something like getting out of the rut would be being more in the present.
Mm-hmm. Are there things that help you become more in the present, particular practices or things that help you do that?
Interestingly enough, I think it's doing the exact thing that is sometimes really bad, which is overthinking. Hmm. I think stopping and just looking at a situation like, my parents did this or my friend did this, and that's really a gesture towards me, and it's not a reflection of them thinking I need something or a reflection to something that I'm missing. Mm-hmm. It's something that is a gift to me, and it's an addition rather than sort of putting something in place of what I have.
Hmm. Well, especially if you think and stay with the facts.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, if you can go fact over emotion, you're halfway there.
Yeah, feelings over facts.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Facts over feelings. And then just to get in the body, you know, mm-hmm. sometimes we can be in the head and these stories loop around and really are scary and turn us upside down. But to just get in the body, and especially for fours, to stay with facts is so helpful.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Thank you. For me, like I think about, I can get obsessive in my mind about thinking about replaying something mm-hmm. over and over. Mm-hmm. And then there's a different part of my mind. Sometimes we call that in the Enneagram, the inner observer, but it's that part of me that says, oh, look at you obsessing about that you don't really need to do that right now. Let's mm-hmm. shift gear. So it is my mind, but I'm using my mind in a different way instead of that obsessiveness.
Sure. Yeah. Along those very lines, it seems almost cliche in our culture right now, but the gratitude practice, mm-hmm. when I find myself going through those same tracks again, you know, just trying to train myself to understand what you're doing and focus on something that you're really grateful for, mm-hmm. You know, doing that as I lay my head on the pillow at night as I'm going down the road, noticing something and giving thanks for that, so that I'm not obsessing about what I don't have. And in point of fact, over the door in my office, I have this huge sign that says, "Be happy with what you have." Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. it's one of those counsels that should come from religious faith, a little bit more of a challenge, perhaps, for a four. And some of the ancient hurts, too. I've done some interesting things, actually going back and visiting certain people at times that had caused me pain in the past, and, you know, realizing what a different person they are now. Mm. Not that person that I am remembering, and that's been helpful in a couple of circumstances. I'm also doing an interesting study practice right now using the book From Aging to Saging, hmm. where those of us in this third part of life, or some people call it the second half of life, can go back and reframe mm-hmm. things that have happened in their lives, so that it's not the utter disaster, you know, that you thought it was at one time, but a help, something that has made you, you know, into what you are now. Mm-hmm. And that's been very helpful.
Just listening to you, Ed, reminds me, it sounds to me like you're using these three pillars of self-awareness, which one is just to be present with yourself so that you can, as you said, Chris, notice that there is an inner observer And the inner observer within all of us does not get hooked into the structure. It stands aside so it can watch us, but we have to be present in order to connect with it. And once we do, we shift attention. So then you're shifting to gratefulness.
Yes.
Or you're allowing the story to take in more of reality so that you see a person who caused an ancient hurt in a different way. That's
very true.
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you for that.
I remember as a late teen, I was in college, and some friends were introducing me to a potential interest that they had for me, and we had an interaction, and then I left, and my friends reported to me, well, when you left, she said, there is an intense young man. And the funny thing was, I thought of that as a compliment, and she did not mean it that way.
Anybody ever described you as intense?
Absolutely. Yep. That's one of those go-to words.
You know, I have a question that came to me just from the introduction that Asher wrote, which is, you lived in Colombia, South America.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder how that shaped you, including your type, what kind of impact that had.
Yeah, I was there during a formative period of my life, from second to fourth grade. I was there with an organization, Mennonite Central Committee. And my family's not Mennonite, but some of my grandparents and other relatives are.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of seeing the daily suffering of people in poverty sort of made me aware of a different perspective in life that I hold today. And I think that's part of the reason why I think I'm different, because I'm aware of those certain things. But also it's part of the reason why I'm aware of sort of empathy-wise and sort of being able to converse with people no matter their class or race or status.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a gift that I've been given, but also it's sort of a curse because you know what's really going on.
Well, you certainly had that filter.
Mm-hmm.
And disposition of four, and that really contributed to making that more real for you, possibly.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
What was it like when you came back to the States?
Well, it was interesting because the rest of my family, we came back because my mom's mother passed away. It's a family of four, just my brother and I and my two parents, and the other three people were super excited to come home. They were tired of living in another place, and they were tired of the daily struggles that it comes with, sort of having to step in between, we work with the poorest of the poor, and we go to school with the richest of the rich.
Mm.
And sort of, they were tired, but I had friends there, and I was young, and I was crying more when we left Colombia than when we went.
Mm.
And that sort of speaks to sort of how, I guess I would consider my experience a little bit different than theirs, just because I felt more accepted by that society. I fit in a little bit better, mm-hmm. or at least I thought I did.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had to do it again in middle school.
Yeah.
And so sort of having to do that twice is not a necessarily fun thing.
For sure. Yeah. For sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Thank you.
Thank you. So, Ed, as you think, you mentioned kind of thinking back in your teenage years, but as you think about that, who you are now and who you were then, you know, is there some wisdom or something you wish you had known at that age that you might offer to Asher or to anybody who's listening?
Yes. I think, in a way, fours may feel a special burden. Younger in life, we, in our search for authenticity, I used to look at my peers when I was a teenager and think, golly, what a bunch of shallow people.
What's your reaction there?
I love your face there, Asher.
I'm right there with you.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah. Indeed. And, you know, it takes a long time to realize, no, they're not shallow. They just look at things in a different kind of way than you do. And there were, unfortunately, there was a real tragic event in my life when I was a teenager, the death of a younger brother, and that cemented a kind of a depressive tendency and outlook that really took me a long time to get around. And for, you know, for anyone that has, you know, has the melancholy that I developed pretty early on, to know that you do grow out of it is a nice thing, or that you can grow out of it anyway. Continuing to do the inner work that all of us have to do, somewhere around year 50 for me, things really began to change. Mm-hmm. The inner teacher mm-hmm. kicked in a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And now I'm quite pleased to be a four, where I couldn't really have said that earlier on.
I love that you said the inner teacher kicked in, because type four is known as an age regressed type. And to know that there is not only an inner child, but an inner elder in there, and to give that inner elder some space, no matter our age, because it's there.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything, Ed, that you could suggest parents or friends of a four who is suffering the death of a dear one?
For me, you know, thinking back on that time, my friends who just came and sat, mm-hmm. like Job's friends, they didn't try to fix me. In some ways, didn't really even try to console me. They just sat with me mm-hmm. in that space and in that pain, and that was a good thing. Mm-hmm. Being supportive, you know, the hug gestures, the unspoken things that that people did were I think very important for me as a four in that time.
The abiding presence.
Yes.
Okay.
What really does not help a four, I don't think it helps anybody, but what doesn't help are those that want to fix you.
Yep. Mm. Yep. Yep. Or I was thinking too, those that want you to rush past the feelings.
Right. Right.
Because we do, I mean, we can get stuck in the feelings, but it's important that we really stay with them and honor the feelings.
Quite so.
Yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah, and if you don't honor those feelings, you get to the what I was talking about earlier, which is you get stuck in those and you get trapped in those, and they can follow you for however long you're around. So yeah, I think you're right.
That's very true. That's a trick for us, is we get stuck in them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
A long time.
That's right.
Well, you know, it becomes, I think, if it's a long time, because Elizabeth Kubler-Ross taught us that a real emotion lasts 90 seconds. After that, we are romancing or stuck in a story loop.
Mm-hmm. It's that word nostalgia that mm-hmm. you use.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chris.
Indeed.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so we're kind of believing a story rather than feeling the emotion. Those are very different.
And if we actually allow ourselves to feel it, then it actually dissipates.
Right,
it
without the story.
It loses the power.
Richard Rohr, one of the commentators that I read, he's a Franciscan and a spiritual teacher that I've done some work with. He's actually written on the Enneagram, and he talks about fours not being genuinely present to their own emotions, which I think
is... Or the authentic emotions.
Yes, which mm-hmm. is what I think you're saying there, mm-hmm. that there's some... We get involved in the story of it, mm-hmm. but not the emotion itself.
Yeah, because the irony is we force value authenticity.
Yeah.
And yet we don't often get to the authentic feeling because we attach to the mm-hmm. story.
Yeah.
Beautifully said.
Yeah. What about you, Asher? What are some things that you know, what the heck, you get to ask Ed, who's somebody who's lived a little longer than you and sort of embodied this fourness. Anything you might ask him, any wonderings, questions?
Well, I mean, I was struck by what you said, how it took you so long to get to where you were at. And that's not necessarily a negative thing, but for people, if they wanted to get there as soon as possible, what do you think would help them get there before 50, or if that's even possible? Because, I mean, if it's not, then that's okay too. It's just part of the process. But
yes, and I think part of it is our own history and, mm-hmm. and where we've come from. Each of us really does have a different path. It's not just me being different. All of us really do have a different path. And I'm not sure. You know, there's that old Zen saying, when the student is ready, the teacher will come. And sometimes it takes someone like me a lot longer before, mm-hmm. Before I'm ready. I do think a gratitude practice is just a good thing altogether. To find your group that you can be real with, and that was a small group for me mm-hmm. back in the day. Small group, and they were actually all in the church, which was very interesting. I don't know if it was a group of fours that I met, you know, just gathered together, but in some ways we all had that similarity that both helped us and, of course, made us more crazy, too, in some ways.
Well, Chris, you too have a gratitude practice. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. It is. It's every day writing down in my... I have a journal that I write specific things, and then I also try to... you named some of this, Ed, but, you know, in driving or in interacting with people, really trying to just find a place of gratitude, which interrupts that habitual pattern of what's missing, what's not there. Mm-hmm. So is that, Escher, anything that you've noticed in your own life?
I mean, certainly I don't write it down, but I try to do that. And I also try to get it out. I try to name it. So if I'm in a conversation or in a situation like, oh, thank you for being present there for me. I mean, at least for me, I can do it in my own head and it's helpful, mm-hmm. but to let others know that I'm capable of doing it is also very important, because sometimes they wouldn't think that you are, because it's all in your head. Like you said, mm-hmm. absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Nice.
Well, comparing mind and gratefulness can't coexist. So that gratefulness practice is really big, because the comparing mind, and you've spoken to it in different ways with different language, is really prevalent in the mind of a four.
Well, thank you both for being here and for sharing of your experiences. And
thanks for having us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Yeah, it's been great. What a gift.
Well, so with heartfelt gratitude, I'm Sandra.
And I'm Chris. And we invite you to continue to look courageously and lovingly at what is. We want to thank all who've made this podcast a reality, including Wake Forest University School of Divinity, for their financial and institutional support. For Sally Ann Morris, who composed our theme music, and for Toby Becker, who provided graphic design.
Thanks to Eric Merle for his editing expertise, to Tom and Lynn Berner, who provided recording space, and to the Narrative Enneagram and our mentors, Helen Palmer and Dr. David Daniels, its founders. And special thanks to all of our guests.
We offer this podcast as a free resource for personal and spiritual growth. And in order to continue this work, we need your support. Please visit our website, heartoftheenneagram.com, to make a contribution and to purchase our companion book.
In the days that lie ahead, may your mind be curious, your heart courageous, and your presence compassionate.